Beyoncé's new documentary film, Homecoming, is the streaming event of the year. In the new concert special, filmed over 2 weekends at Coachella, Queen Bee gives fans a backstage look at her rehearsals, proving she is the hardest working woman in show business.
And when it comes to business, nobody does it quite like Beyoncé, who is getting a history in the making, $60 million for 3 Netflix specials. Today, rhythm and blues musician Earth St. James joins us to take a look at Beyoncé's Homecoming documentary and his emotional moment opening for his idol, Erykah Badu.
Plus, the new play, Lottery Day at Goodman Theater, is sold out.
Gay black football star Michael Sam feels the gay community abandoned him.
And how much does it cost to dress up like Beyoncé at Coachella? Play our game and find out. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people just like you. Thank you. Become a member and support this show at feastoffun.com/plus.
Oh, no. My imitation of Beyoncé is more Maya Rudolph's imitation of Beyoncé than actual Beyoncé. I love Maya. Oh, no. Hey, folks, Beyoncé's Homecoming Netflix special is on the menu on today's Feast of Fun. Joining us is the delightful, soulful, gorgeous Earth St. James.
What up? What's going on?
Musician, brother, lover, father, mother, child, adult, cosmic being.
And he likes to get dirty. That's why his name is Earth.
Yeah, baby. The ground. Baby, the dirt. The soil.
So before we get into talking about Beyoncé with you, one important moment in your musical career was opening for the great Erykah Badu.
Yes. So actually, I did it twice.
You did it twice.
So the first time I opened up for Erykah was in 2008. I went to Grambling State University. Mm-hmm. And Grambling is in Louisiana. It's a small HBCU, which is a historically black college university. Erykah Badu went to Grambling as well, too. That's actually why I applied.
Oh, really?
To go to Grambling. I didn't know anything about Grambling. I read her bio, and they said, oh, she went to Grambling State University. I said, okay, well, I'm going to apply. And I applied and got accepted. But
as a music studies major?
So I was a theater major.
Theater major.
I applied as a theater major. We had this acting competition that was in Dallas every year. And she would happen to be the artist that was going to perform at this event. So I went down there and they said, hey, we need people to open up for her. So I was playing guitar. I had my guitar. So I did an opening act. It was like a 30-minute. Well, no, it was probably like a 15-minute set. So that was 08. And then 2015, she came back to Grambling for Homecoming. And they said, hey, I know that you're not at Grambling anymore, but do you want to come down to open for Erykah?
I was like, sure. They remembered you way back from 2008.
They remember it because while I was at Grambling, I was from 07, 2012. And every year I would ask, hey, can we get Erykah back down here? Mm. Can she come back down here for homecoming? Like, I really want to see Erykah. I know she went here, like, just bring her down to perform. And I told myself, I was like, I bet once I leave, she'll come back down here. And then once I left, she came back down in 2015. And they called me the same day they announced it and said, hey, do you want to come open for Erykah?
I imagine when you heard the news, there was a lot of feelings running through your head. Were you ever doubtful?
I never felt like I wasn't worthy.
Were you worried that she might not like you?
No.
Because you were ready for it.
I was ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
I was ready for it.
How did you decide what you were going to play for her?
I was just doing me. Like, because like I say, I left in 2012 and from Grambling, and then I came back home 2013. So from 13 to 15, I had been performing. I had been doing shows. So like I had owned my craft. I was already kind of established in my artistry. So like when they said, hey, come down, I was like, cool, no problem. I think the biggest thing for me was trying to condense all I want to do in a 20-minute set. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest thing for me.
Did you get to interact with her?
With her. So I met her after the show. The funny thing about that is that I opened up for her at 8 p.m., and she didn't go onto stage until almost like 1 in the morning.
So you performed at 8 p.m. For a crowd.
For a crowd.
And how many acts between you and her were there?
Before I went on, it was maybe 2 acts before me. I was the last act before she was supposed to come on.
Okay.
So I went on, I think I did from maybe 8:15 to maybe like 8:30. 40 mm-hmm. or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, cool. So he's going to come in at 9. And at the school, they were really like, okay, we're in the time limit. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. No problem. So I kept everything tight. In that time, very tight mm-hmm. in that time frame. Almost 4 hours later.
Well, what kind of why? Why would it take so long to get to this?
Well, one thing was, I know there was I think it was like a big, if something happened with the planes. So she was in Dallas, but I knew she was coming because when I did the sound check at 5 o'clock, her instruments were already there. So the instruments were there, the stage was already set up for her band. So everything was already there. But I think she was still in Dallas. Mm. So she did an Instagram post and was like, hey, Gremlin, I'm coming. I'm just stuck in Dallas. Oh. Something's going on with the planes.
So it wasn't like she was backstage. She wasn't being a
diva. She was not being a diva. She wasn't even. So that's why. So our interaction was after the show had happened. So at almost maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, this is our interaction, you know, compared to her being there when the show started.
So what did she say to you when you actually met her?
Well, so she didn't see me perform. So she didn't see me because.
So you're just like, I love you. Dallas. She's like, thank you, baby.
So I was, that's really what it was. That's really what it was.
Was there any kind of, I mean, because I know this meant a lot for you.
It did.
And talk about the feelings that you were experiencing when you were sort of there in that context, in that show.
So one thing for me was the fact that I was going back to my old college. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So you had people. So homecoming is a big thing for any college, any black college. Like homecoming is the pinnacle of the year. You know, so I think the fact that I was opening for her was a blessing. But the fact that I can go back down there and see all my old friends and people that saw me grind from 07 mm-hmm. and see this evolution of Earth St. James, for them to see that from 07 up until now, I think that was the biggest thing for me. So I think it was just a moment of being proud to be on this stage and being honored to be on this stage, because they could have called anybody. You know, the university could have called anybody and say, hey.
They could have invited Beyonce to do it.
I mean, exactly. They could have called anybody and say, hey, I want you to come back down here and
Paula
open.
Paula Abdul.
Yeah, but the fact.
Janet Jackson.
But the fact that they called me, you know what I'm saying? Like, the day that it was announced.
Yeah.
And I remember I was at home. They announced it. And I was like, I knew it. I said, once I leave, I knew everyone was going to come back. I knew that. But then I think maybe 30 minutes later, they called me and said, hey, do you want to come open for her? We'll pay for everything. We'll get you down here. I was like, wow.
Well, in Beyonce's Netflix special, yes. which is a documentation, not just of her performances last year at Coachella, or as DJ Khalid calls Beychella.
Beychella.
Beychella, honey. Yes, history in the making.
Yes.
It's showing us the behind the scenes look at sort of how she's putting those shows together.
Correct.
And I imagine for, you know, recruiting a lot of this talent from these historic black colleges is something really powerful and really important for all these people to be working with arguably one of the most commercially successful entertainers of the modern age, you know, and certainly like with her and her husband, Mark, how much are they making?
Like 1.2 or 1.6 billion.
Billionaire.
The billionaire.
He's worth like 900 million and she's worth like
500 million.
300 something. Well, yeah. At the time, article I had, but maybe at this point.
Probably at the point, yeah.
And although Beyonce compares herself to Bill Gates, as Chris Rock says, if Bill Gates woke up tomorrow with Oprah's money, he'd kill himself.
Right. It's not enough.
Yeah. It's not enough. In terms of like Beyonce doing this show,
yes,
it's extremely important to pay tribute to these black colleges. And in terms of like, you know, showing us the behind the scenes look, it's really fantastic because we had to see how these performances are being put together. And I just imagine, you know, I wanted you to come on the podcast to sort of talk about the impact of seeing this Netflix special, because people are calling it the streaming event of the year.
I agree.
Which seems a little bit of an exaggeration, but I don't think it is. It's making Netflix a ton of money right now.
Well, how much did she get paid for it? Do we know?
I heard $4 million.
Yeah.
Okay.
But she also got a chance to own the rights to the entire performance. She can do whatever she wants with it. So I heard $4 million, but we never know. Mm-hmm. We never know. But also Netflix gave her then a $60 million deal for other specials. Mm-hmm. So I think the next special that's
coming
out.
Three specials. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think May 20 something. I think it's supposed to be her Formation World Tour. It's supposed to be on Netflix. So I think that was the deal.
And now CBS All Access, Disney, all these other streaming channels, they're like, who? We got Beyonce, honey. Netflix is like, we're not going nowhere.
Exactly. I think it was so important. I think it was so necessary. I think everybody now is becoming the Beyonce. If you don't like Beyonce, I think we're looking at you like, why don't you like Beyonce? Why don't you like her?
Because I flunked out of college.
Well, she didn't go to college herself, and she says, and this is like, this is, you know, Destiny's Child was my college. So I think it's interesting, you know, that she's taking this college motif, right? Because what we see is basically a marching band and dancers. And
dancers.
As her
Greek letters.
Greek life, right?
Right. As her orchestra and, you know, doing the moves and performing, you know, because it's something that she said that she grew up with. She would watch, she'd go to these college games,
right?
And during those halftime games or before the games, you'd see that marching band really perform and really put out,
right?
You know,
right?
And so, you know, for her, it's hearkening back to something that's, you know, she had from her youth, and maybe she missed out on going to a university, and this is a way to kind of present to the world as like, I'm accomplished. I did something.
Exactly.
And I think the New York Times says, you know, this is the thing that, you know, it's Beyonce trying to portray herself as she wants you to see her as, you know, very hardworking and a perfectionist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think this show everything was so pro-black.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was so pro-black, from the music to the dancers to the band to the culture to even the quotes. The quotes from Maya Angelou, the quotes from Nina Simone, the sound bites from Nina Simone, everything was just...
W.E.B. Du Bois.
Exactly. I mean, everything was so...
Toni Morrison.
Everything was so pro-black. And me watching it, and I was thinking, I was like, for her to be Beyonce, one of the biggest artists of all time, she didn't have to do that. She didn't have to make everything so pro-black.
Because, you know, when you look historically, it affected other people. When one of the opening dialogues, you know, the voiceovers was of Nina Simone talking about, like, why do I want it to be so black?
Yeah.
Why am I doing this so
right.
much? Because I want black people to understand who they are, and I want them to celebrate who they are. And you could see that, you know, Beyonce and Nina suffered for it. You know,
she did
not get a lot of work because of that statement. And I think that, you know, somebody like Beyonce does stand on the shoulders of somebody like Nina Simone.
Yeah.
And so I love that she wants to pay tribute to her. And also, you know, it's still the same fight. We're still going through the same things that people have gone through for ages.
Well, this is the thing about, like, you know, as content creators, as people who are in the margins on one way or another, as, you know, Puerto Rican or black or queer or, you know, it's like it is this challenge that we're always presented, which is how much do you celebrate your culture and who you are without alienating your potential audience? And someone told me once that when you try to play to everybody, you play to no one.
Right.
But the thing about Beyonce that's really exciting, and I think this is something that I try to do with my own artwork, is that I want to speak about my experience as a disenfranchised person and celebrate being queer and Puerto Rican, but at the same time, make it accessible and exciting for people who are not.
Right. Right.
And then when I always think about, like, black culture and movies and television shows and stuff, it's always like, well, that's for a black audience and not, you know, and not for other people who might not appreciate it. And I'm like saying, listen, you know, if it's fun to watch, if it's exciting, it's for everybody.
It's for everybody. I totally agree. I don't think just because she portrayed a lot of the blackness or being pro-black that you have to be black to watch it. Or if you're not black, you can appreciate that. You know what I'm saying? I think that this is showing you how to take pride in your culture. You know what I'm saying?
In yourself.
And yourself. You know what I'm saying? And it allows you to, say, okay, you know what? I see that Beyonce put a lot of emphasis on being pro-black and the black experience. So now I'm inspired to talk about the Puerto Rican experience or the Italian experience. Or, you know what I mean? I think that she opened up that door. To say, hey, it's okay to talk about your culture and talk about, you know, what's important to you and what you feel. And I feel like for her to be that big of an artist and to say, you know what, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, or I'm mm-hmm. not going to try to dumb it down or be marketable. I'm going to do what I want to do. You know what I mean? I think that's one thing that I think we respect about this documentary.
Barry Gordy put a lot of pressure on Marvin Gaye not to sing political songs.
Correct.
Right.
Sure did.
People don't know about that history. And then Stevie Wonder came along and said, do you like my look? Do you like my music?
It's going to be real.
Yeah.
And that, opened up a lot of opportunities for a lot of, you know, Stevie Wonder's success in writing about the black experience from a political angle allowed a lot of black entertainers to not just sing about romance.
Right.
It's a reason why, you know, someone like Barry White is mostly pussy begging music, you know?
Yes.
And a lot of these entertainers wanted to talk about the civil rights struggle of their time, but their record labels discouraged it.
Especially in the 60s, the 70s. I mean, and sometimes even in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But more for the 60s and 70s, I mean, we were just coming out of a very racial divide in the 60s. After King passed away in 68, you know, like we were trying to get. So once the 70s came along, it was still more, I guess, more free, but it still wasn't as free as it is, I guess, now. You know, mm-hmm. but I definitely agree with you. Artists, they were trying to make their money. They were trying to just sell records. They were trying to.
But I argue right now that they're still people are still struggling with this today.
Part
of it is like they don't want to be defined themselves by who they are. My mother told me is like, you guys would be a lot more successful if Feast of Fun wasn't a gay fun show. It's just a fun show. And part of me is like, I don't know how else to be who
how's
I am.
To be. That's who you are.
But, you know, in terms of you, like, and I talk about you and your music, like, you know, you're very comfortable in being a queer person. Mm-hmm. And you feel like your queer experience is not something that's front and center when you're a musician.
I agree.
And can you talk a little bit about how that decision works for you?
I feel like because if I wasn't a queer person, I would still mm-hmm. love the same music I love. I would still write the same way. I would still dress the same way that I dressed. I feel like that should not determine my growth or my success. You know what I mean? I feel like, you know, mm-hmm. being queer is just who you love. Who you choose to love, who you choose to be with. But I feel like when it comes to writing and music, that should be universal. That should just be, you know.
And that's why it's so important, like, for Beyonce to be pro-queer and pro-LGBT mm-hmm. and sort of bringing a lot of show, you know, elements of voguing and ball dance moves into her concerts, you know.
And I feel like, you know, it's okay to be pro whatever, you know what I mean, as an artist. Like, I'm not just pro-black.
Pro-Chick-fil-A.
Right. Like, I'm not,
you'd be out of business. Let's just put it that way.
I'm not just pro-black. I'm not just pro-queer. I'm pro...
You're about the music.
About the music, but I'm pro-everybody. I'm mm-hmm. pro-Italian. I'm pro-whoever wants to be seen and be heard and has a voice. You know what I mean? It's not even about just being, you know... I don't think that because I'm mm-hmm. black... then just my issues matter. Just black issues matter.
Women's issues matter. Children's matter.
Everything matters to me.
Are you
exactly.
saying all lives matter?
All lives matter. Black lives matter. But I feel like I do agree that all lives do matter. And I feel like sometimes...
Well, it's the diminishing the statement of Black Lives Matter, that it's like, you know, we need to look at police violence and discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
That's... You know,
that's what it's talking about.
We're joking about
you
that.
Know,
but,
what I think is interesting, what I love so much about Homecoming 2 is just her celebration of the black marching band. Because me growing up, you know, marching bands and people who were in marching band, that was like the squarest
you were thing lame.
You could
right,
do.
Right. You were lame for that,
you know?
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
How did that change? When did that change? Like, where did that... I mean, I'm guessing it came from the black universities.
Black universities.
Yeah.
And I think that... being at a black university, that honestly, the bands and the battle of the mm-hmm. bands, that was the highlight of the football game
mm-hmm.
or of the season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think.
Well, describe the battle of the bands for a lot of people who, because, you know, we have a lot of gay people listening to the show. They have not watched a football game.
Yeah.
They have not come to a football game.
Yes.
When the football game was happening at the university,
yes.
they were somewhere else.
Gotcha. So think of I guess, the Battle of the Bands, or just like just the band playing as like the halftime show at Super Bowl. So you have your two quarters, or your, I don't know, maybe I'm saying the wrong thing, but you have your two quarters of football, and then you have halftime, and then you have, you know, after that, two more quarters. But for the black experience, people will really come for the band. The band would play for 20 minutes or 15 minutes, and that would be a whole experience in itself. The fact that, you know, the band is playing, and people would come just for that.
And when you say the Battle of the Bands, what do you mean by that?
So Battle of the Bands was actually when you would take another HBCU and...
Historically Black College.
Correct.
Okay.
HBCU.
HBCU.
Historically Black College.
So for me, so I went to Grambling. So Grambling is in Louisiana. And our, I guess, rival is Southern University, which is still in Louisiana, but it's in Baton Rouge. So Grambling is actually in Grambling, Louisiana. Southern is in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which is 4 hours away from each other. But this Battle of the Bands has been going on for maybe 40 years, 30 years, 35 years. It's been going on. So we all go to New Orleans the weekend of Thanksgiving, and we have Battle of the Bands. So that's really what it is.
So it's like the marching bands of the corresponding football team sort of battle it out to see who can put on a better, more dazzling show.
Correct.
I think the 2002 film Drumline, starring Nick Cannon and Zoe Saldana, who are huge stars today, but at that time they were relatively unknown, is sort of what brought that into the pop culture surface.
I agree. It did.
And it's not just a band that's performing, but it's also there's dancers. And it's,
there's, so you have the band, you have the dancers, which at our school was called the Orchesis. And like I said, and what I love about Homecoming is that Beyonce captured the essence of not just the band, but the dancers. You know, and the choreography of the dancers and the, I guess the structure of how these dancers are
operating
at HBCUs. You know what I mean? So for me personally, just sitting down and watching it, it really took me back to Grambling and just being in college and just going to the games and going to the Battle of the Bands or coming to, we have something called Bayou Classic, and Bayou Classic is where it is, two different schools, two black schools coming together and having a battle and battling it out.
Because watching the dancing of this stuff is just like, some of it is just like, how are they even doing some of those moves? It's just, it's so mesmerizing.
Yeah. Well, because it's really great when they sort of pop and lock, and then they use the strobe light to accentuate that movement. And you're like, this, there's a little bit of, you know, technical effects there alongside the dance.
All right, of course, of course.
Now, a lot of people on the internet are like, how's Beyonce changing from yellow to pink? And I'm like, well, it's called editing.
It was a 2 day thing. I mean, it was a two weekend thing. Yeah.
But she also did it over two different weekends.
Correct.
Yeah, so the first weekend is yellow.
Okay.
And so you, if you look at the footage closely, the yellow is a little bit, as Beyonce calls it, more ratchet than the pink one, which is their dance moves are tight, tight, tight.
Right.
And so when they're cutting from the, it's always like really interesting, the yellow and the pink, because you can see how the casserole that she's serving to that audience, how the flavors are melding from one weekend to the next.
Exactly. I think that was so important, and I'm so glad that she put both of those performances into one.
People on Twitter, they're like, you know, they're like, this Beyonce has witchcraft or something, because she's switching colors back and forth.
No, I mean, but if you know about Coachella, that's what it is. It's a you do it 1 week and then you do it the following weekend.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So that's what it is.
And so the fans can sort of see that performance evolve.
Exactly. But I'm glad that she said, you know what, I'm going to combine both of those into one and give you a full experience of what I had or what I did, you know what I mean?
At some point in time, we should point out that Coachella, the guy who owns Coachella, has donated a lot of money to anti-gay causes. So I just want to put that out there so people know that we are aware of it.
Yeah, Sonny.
I didn't know that.
I am going to break into Beyonce's dressing room and steal her boots. Just letting you know, Beyonce, those boots are mine. They look like they're right off of sequinqueens.com.
Well, what are they? They're like white boots with some kind of like iridescent little fringe or something. Yeah. Like that. You could probably, you know, if you found that fabric, you could probably glue some of that stuff onto.
I mean, she even said it. I think it was a guy or sorry, a trans in the audience. And she was like, I can't believe you have my outfit on.
A trans person was wearing it?
Yes.
Because that would have been the second week, so they saw it the first week.
It was the second week. And then Beyonce, it was on the film. Mm-hmm. She said...
She pointed, it was really
oh my God, like, you have my outfit on. Like, how you do it that quick? Like, Beyonce was even blown away at the fact that these people were having their outfits on, or her outfits on, and the boots and everything, you know?
So. That's impressive, though. If you go to Coachella one weekend and you have a week to, you know, or go to sequinqueens.com and order yourself some Beyonce boots.
Exactly.
They're really wonderful. Mark was commenting on her presenting white glove service in terms of like accentuating the movement. In the opening sequence.
Well, it's dark because, you know, it's dark, you know, you're in a theater. And so you like, you want to see people move.
Right.
And so you want to have something that's going to pop. So you wear those little, you know, the white jazz gloves and then you can see it. But I'm sure they probably do that in the bands too,
a typical thing to have gloves on and that's part, sequence and just, you know, something flashy,
and that's part of the reason why they say like Michael Jackson used to wear like white socks, you know, and kind of like short pants, so you could see that movement, because otherwise it gets lost.
Exactly.
I have to say I have a bone to pick with Beyonce.
Okay.
Introducing the expression hot sauce in her swag bag.
Okay.
Her bag swag.
Bag swag. Mm. Hot sauce in her bag swag. And then like Hillary Clinton like pulling out a bottle of hot sauce. Like,
I remember that.
I'm like, I've never heard of Hillary Clinton ever having a bottle of hot sauce until Beyonce sang about it.
She lived in Arkansas.
She may have enjoyed it.
There's a lot of things they do to try and present, you know, presidential candidates as being human beings, you know, and get people to relate.
Let's be honest. Try to get the black vote.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Hillary do that, she was trying to get that black vote.
How many drag queens just from cooking with drag queens alone, how many drag queens have pulled out a bottle of hot sauce from their bra or their bag and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. And that comes from Beyonce.
It comes from Beyonce.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Big Frida, you know, is sort of like was launched in the mainstream. And this is the danger, I think, in terms of like when, you know, some disenfranchised voices go this big, this huge, is there is a watering down effect of our culture, you know, grassroots culture getting sort of like everybody's into it all of a sudden. And now it belongs to nobody.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like it is in some ways and some people talk about cultural appropriation or cultural theft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm glad Beyonce is the one who's capitalizing and cashing in on this. And at the same time, I hope that the success of Beyonce's music and career inspires people to sort of further pursue to see someone like you perform on stage.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm so inspired by just what she brings to the table.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's an amazing vocalist, but she's an even better performer. You know what I mean?
And are you tempted to like bring a little bit of, you know, Beyonce moves into your performances or like choreography?
That's not my style. That's not my thing. You know what I'm saying? Like I can appreciate Beyonce for what she gives. I can appreciate.
But people ask you to do it sometimes, don't they?
No.
You know, like, oh, here's a dressing room for your 12 dancers, and you're just me.
because I feel like that's not my scene. That's not what I bring to the table. I feel like people that know who I am as an artist, they know that I'm all about the music and the band. Like my band is the biggest thing for me. I think her band is the biggest thing for her, but I think her gimmick also is being an amazing dancer. And, you know what I mean? That's just not, I mean, I think it's two different genres as well, too. I'm not a pop artist. I'm not an R&B artist. That's not the type of artist I am. I'm a soul singer. I'm a jazz singer. In that field, it doesn't require the dancing and the extensive choreography.
You're like, I mean, I gotta say, you know, Earth, you're always put together.
Thank you.
You know, You make that, what is it? That happy, what was it, a Farrell hat that you're wearing?
Yeah.
Farrell Williams hat. You're actually making it work.
Thank you.
You know, yeah. It's not as aggressive, though.
It's not it? As aggressive. It's very subtle, but it's still, yes.
It makes and you it's a good hat for this weather.
It's a good hat for this weather, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But I imagine, do you have, like, your own sort of, you think of your performances, what you wear as a costume to some degree? Because I know Beyonce, when she's done with her, you know, boots, she puts them in the closet and in a bag and doesn't touch them to the next show.
I agree. But I think just me as Irv St. James, that's a... it's not a gimmick, but I feel like it is a character. It is a something I'm portraying to be. I think outside of being Irv St. James or being on the stage, and when I'm Duran, I think I'm a totally different person. I'm still Earth. Earth is still me, mm-hmm. but it's just, you know, when I'm on stage, it's a whole different person, a whole different persona, a whole different...
do you have friends and family that actually call you Earth? Like, I mean, besides us on the podcast, but like, you know, because I know for like some drag entertainers, like their drag names, you know, or just anybody whose stage name becomes so ubiquitous that mm-hmm. it overshadows the name that their friends and family call them.
So my family is always, I'm always D or DD.
DD?
DD. That's my name back in the day.
You let the cat out of the bag.
My name is Duran. So, I mean, so my family, I'm either D or DD. So I'm never Earth to family. Mm. Some friends still know me as Duran, or I used to go by Brother Earth in high school. I know, right? So that's where Earth comes from.
Where did the name Earth come from? Somebody just said you like to get dirty, and so you're gonna...
No. Honestly, how I got the name Earth. So I was in high school. I was a freshman in high school, and I was in environmental science class.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking about Mother Earth and all of this stuff. And I was like, I don't know, as a 14-year-old, I was like, okay, Mother Earth, but is there like a Father Earth? Or, I don't know.
It's a Father Sky.
But I was like, is there a Father Earth? I was like, it's a Mother Earth. Where's the Father Earth? So I started calling myself Father Earth. And then somebody, and I wrote it on my notebook. And somebody looked at my notebook and said, Father Earth. It was like, it sounds like you're trying to be God.
Well, you're like the gay Kanye.
Yeah, I was like, it's like it sounds like you're trying to be God. And I was like, oh, I didn't think about that. So I was like, okay, well, let's scratch Father. I'm going to put Brother Earth. I like that. Brother Earth.
What do you react to when you see Kanye West compare himself to Jesus and stuff?
He
just took a big sigh.
I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to... because Kanye is a hometown hero. Kanye
is... He's a Chicago guy.
He is. Yeah. So I don't want to say the wrong thing. I am...
Well, you feel like you have feelings that are not... not the most positive about him based on his actions.
I think,
but you want to celebrate him as a hometown hero.
I agree. It's complicated.
I think we all should be. I think we all should think that we're gods. I think we all are gods and goddesses.
God's inside every one of you, baby.
I think so. So when he said, you know, what I mean, I think that we should all want to possess that, you know, to be a god or a goddess. You know, what I mean,
and celebrate the divine in
exactly,
everyone.
Exactly. But I think that.
With a little humility.
What Kanye is coming from, I think, is more of a worship me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's
and you're not, you know, cool. You're not
worship Kanye
mm-hmm.
instead of, you know, just worship the God in you
mm-hmm.
or the goddess in you or the spirituality in you or the potential in you or the strength in you. And I feel like how he's going about it, and I could be wrong because
mm-hmm.
I don't know Kanye. I haven't sat down and talked to him, you know, but from the outside looking in, it seems like it's worship Kanye.
Sure. Well, the thing about Kanye is complicated because, you know, he's a brilliant artist in so many respects, but he also has some really just, you know, fucked up ideas.
Yeah.
And it seems pretty clear to me that, you know, he struggles with some mental health issues.
Of course.
You know, there's some stuff going on there. And so it's like, you know, when he says outrageous things or does outrageous things, it's like, it's hard to like be like, you know, you're at fault for this kind of thing because, there's a mental health struggle going on there.
And that's
what he does contribute and what he does have to offer.
That's why I was like, when you ask me the question, I had to do the heavy sigh mm-hmm. and kind of think about what I was going to say, because that mental health does, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. come into effect. I don't want that to be a crutch for him and we just excuse his behavior because of mental health. But I don't know. I just feel like he knows what he's doing as well, too. I think Kanye knew what he was doing when he started this Sunday service. Because before that, his name was being dragged through the mud.
What's the Sunday service for people who aren't aware of it?
So I think it's every Sunday he just brings these artists and these musicians and they have like a Sunday service. So they do all of these uplifting spiritual type songs, or they might take a song that's not a gospel song per se and make it a spiritual type
song. Do you see this on song. Facebook Live or something, or is it an actual event?
So, like, I mean, for me personally, I didn't know it was an every week thing. Mm-hmm. I think now it's an every week thing. He just did it at Coachella.
So, where am I blanking on him?
Kanye
West kept going like Chris Brown. So Kanye is performing every single Sunday somewhere on this planet. That's a rough gig.
I don't want to be pretty misquoted, often. But I think that, I mean, yeah. I think it's maybe every week. I think it's in the same spot though.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So he's like a residency right
but
now.
But I think for Coachella,
yeah.
And I know for Coachella, they actually built that stage for him at Coachella. Like if you go to, I think, Facebook or YouTube and type in Kanye West Coachella, it gives you a time lapse of how these the construction workers were actually making the stage for him at Coachella. You know, so yeah,
it's cool. Cute. I'm looking at photos of it. Yeah.
Now, you're familiar.
It looks like a scene from Jesus Christ Superstar, though.
Right.
You know, literally, they're like dancing in a desert.
What I would say, I just think that the reason why Kanye is doing more of this Sunday soul or this, you know, this Kanye service is because he's trying to get back into the good graces of Black people.
Do you feel like he's strained his relationships
with Jordan,
slavery was a choice and supporting Trump?
Slavery was a choice of supporting Trump. Like, a lot of Black people, we were like, Kanye, we're about to cancel you. You're canceled. Yeah. Like, we can't. And I think that the fact that he went back to his roots mm-hmm. of being musical, he's like, okay, I need to win these people back. I could be totally wrong, mm-hmm. but that's just how I'm interpreting it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's like, you know what? I got to get my sales back up. I got to get my.
So when he did the Trump stuff and he did the slavery was a choice kind of thing, it was like, did most people did they take it seriously or were they just kind of like, oh, God, this guy's crazy?
Both.
Yeah.
Both. Okay.
Now, you're familiar with Michael Sam, right? In 2014, he was the first openly gay football player drafted into the NFL.
Yes.
And he didn't last too long in the NFL, but he did get a reality TV series on Oprah's channel on OWN. Yeah, I think they followed him around for that. And then he went and played Canadian football for a while. And he said he couldn't get a job, and he started doing drugs and drinking and whatnot. And he broke up with his boyfriend, and then he went to Peru and did ayahuasca, which is like this, you know, drug you take, and I think it gave him like some kind of spiritual opening. But he now is saying that he still feels like the gay community has abandoned him, and he can't, like, it's hard, like, he can't get work at this point in time. Yeah.
So I didn't know about mm-hmm. all of that. I haven't been keeping up with Sam mm-hmm. like that, but I didn't know about that.
Mm. Well, wow. I don't know much about football players, but I do know about hot men. Mm. He's not ugly.
He's not.
He's a gorgeous, gorgeous man. Great personality. We actually ran into him at a gay bar here in Chicago, and okay. I approached him. I said, "Michael Sam, we would love to talk to you on the podcast." And he was just like, he gave me some contact information. I followed up with it and never heard back from him.
Nothing.
And part of it is like, you know, I know how difficult it is to be. Like, I can relate to it. Obviously, I'm not Michael Sam. I haven't been in it, but mm-hmm. when the whole world wants to a piece of you, they want to tell your story, and it's a hard thing to manage. And now, you know, a lot of football plans are saying like, listen, Michael Sam would still have a career if he could play football well, but he was sort of trying to, you know, use his coming out story to try to strong arm himself into getting drafted
right.
into teams that he was not qualified to play for.
Right.
And that's a tricky thing. I don't know if he was qualified or not, because I don't know enough about football. Mm-hmm. And I do know that probably that may have caused problems, right? The football teams didn't want a player overshadowing the whole team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with camera crews and documentary people following him around to the locker room and around practices, I can imagine that must have been difficult for him to keep that career.
Definitely.
So those are choices he made, and, you know, he has to live with them. And part of it is, you know, football is a young man's game. And as you age out of it, it can be a tricky thing to do. You know, it's like to play another sport, sort of stay in the media eye. You know, Mark and I have felt at times that we have been ignored or, you know, taken advantage of by gay news organizations or gay rights organizations. But does it mean that we don't feel embraced by our own community? Mm-hmm. Because a community is anything you want it to be. And it's a reflection of you as a person.
Right.
Your community is who you know, the people in your neighborhood. They're the people that you meet each day.
Exactly.
As they said on Sesame Street, right? And part of it is like, it does bother me sometimes when I hear trans people or people of color or Latinx people, you know, talk about the gay community as mostly a cisgendered white space. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that may be somebody else's gay queer community, but it's not going to be yours. Yours is going to be a reflection of you.
Right. But when it comes to Michael Sam, him being a black gay man, you know, like in the black community, you know, even though I feel like we've come a long way in our community, it's still that the thing of it's not accepted, it's not talked about in the family, it's not, you know, but I feel like, you know, and when it comes to my white brother and sister, and, you know, it's a little bit more comfortable, it's a little bit more acceptable in their family than it is in the black family and in the black community as well, too. You know, so I don't want to base his sexuality and his race on the fact that he can't get work. Maybe he was just a bad player. Maybe it just didn't have anything to do with the fact that he was black and that he was gay. Maybe once he actually got into the NFL, he just didn't make the cut, or maybe he just couldn't. You know, handle but the also, pressure,
you know,
of
there's
it.
Always careers like after football. You know what I mean? I think maybe he expected to be like continue to be a spokesperson for gay people and maybe get a job with a gay organization or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, they offered him to be on the box of Fruity Cheerios and he said no to that.
Well, I would have said, like, I'll take
kidding.
It. Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
That's the thing about this as well, too. We don't know who he was behind the scenes.
Yeah. He was lovely. You know,
wasn't his boyfriend's family like the mafia?
They were involved with the mob, too. So, you know, allegedly.
Allegedly.
Don't come after me.
Well, allegedly.
I'm just a podcaster.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know. You know what I'm saying? And I feel like I don't want to base everything off of the fact that he was gay and he was black, that he couldn't get work. Just because you're gay and black doesn't mean that you're a nice person.
Right.
Or that you're
And the media does do this kind of thing. They build you up, and they use you towards whatever it is, and they want to use you. And then when they're done with you...
They're done with you.
And so that's why it's like, you know, you got to pick up the pieces yourself after that, really.
Right.
Okay, guys, we're going to go shopping for clothes right now. Yes. Beyonce!
Come on.
How much does it cost to dress up like the Queen Bey herself?
Ooh.
We're going to play The Price is Right.
Okay. Let's go.
Okay, Mark. Up for bids is the pink Balmain. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing this correctly. Beyonce printed hoodie with the rhinestones in the center. What do you bid for that? We're trying to get the
one she wore?
The one she wore, okay. But the one of the same brand, same, you know, it's like, if you want to buy the exact same one.
Just the hoodie.
The hoodie, just the self.
I would say...
How much are you going to spend on this?
How much would I spend or
no,
what
no,
I
wait,
think?
Wait.
What
this
do you
is,
think
the price
for?
Is right. We're bidding for... And if you go over it, just bid $1.
$250.
Mark?
$251.
You won, Mark. It's $595. Yeah.
Next.
No guy.
The Louboutin Coachella boots, honey. These are fucking expensive.
Okay, those ones, how much are those? Those are $3,500.
$1,050.
$10?
$10,000?
No, 10 1,050.
You're pretty close. 1,595.
Okay.
Damn, honey. It costs a lot of money to look this good.
What else?
That's it. That's all she wore. And her Daisy Dukes. Those are like $5.
Her personal panties. How much do we pay for that?
You know, we work with so many drag queens. It's like when she first came out in Homecoming and she's kind of wearing the Pharaoh outfit and stuff like that.
Yeah. Can we talk about that? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I'm looking at her hips and stuff like that. I'm like, is she padded or is that all her?
I think that was my favorite part of the entire documentary. Mm-hmm. When she walked on stage, like once the drummer played,
she had two different looks.
She did two different looks, but they were very similar. The common theme was the crown. It was a crown in each one, and I love how she kind of just walked on stage and owned the fact that look, I am Queen Beyonce. I feel like she's earned that title. She's earned that title.
I do like going on YouTube and watching videos of Beyonce at the gym squatting with weights.
Okay.
You know, and I'm like, because real women squat, okay? Okay. And she got that. She has, do not fuck with Beyonce. She is strong. You know? She will outdance you.
But that's, can we talk about how she was at 218 pounds after she gave birth to the twins? Because, you know, she's supposed to do Coachella.
That's called thick.
She was supposed to do Coachella.
Flavorful.
In 2017. But she got pregnant, so she had to postpone it. That's why she did it a year later.
That's Blue.
But once she had,
what was the name of that child?
So no,
that's with Blue Ivy.
No. Blue Ivy was like years ago.
Yeah.
But 2017, she got the twins.
Okay,
she got pregnant with the twins. Excuse me. Then she gave birth, and she did Coachella 2018. Mm-hmm. But when she after she gave birth, her post pregnancy weight was 218. And she said in the documentary that she
that's what I weigh.
But see, but your muscle, you know what I mean. But for her, to be a female and not that muscular, to be 218, and not to be as tall as you, that's kind of big.
Yeah.
So, but she said that she went on a strict diet. Yeah. It was no carbs, no sugar, no meat, no fish, no nothing.
Mm-hmm. She Beyonce is 5'7".
Okay.
She was eating apples. You know what I'm saying?
She got down to raisins, honey. Not even apples.
those both have too much sugar content. It was probably like arugula.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah. But I mean, but I really respect the fact that she was so determined, because this whole performance took her 8 months to prepare for.
Yeah.
It was 4 months of vocal and music rehearsal, and then 4 months of just dance rehearsal.
But that's not uncommon, though, for a show, is it? Don't a lot of shows take a long, long time to prepare?
Not that long. I mean, then again, I could be wrong. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? But just thinking about, you know, this artist that, I mean, but who else is doing what she's doing?
Mm.
Earth St. James.
But I'm not giving you
it was a big
this
production.
For production. Yeah. I'm not giving you all of this. But just think about what other artist out here besides Beyonce is giving you this full out production that she gave you. Mm. I mean, Ariana Grande, maybe Taylor Swift.
You know, the last two divas I've seen in concert were Cher, it was wonderful, and Madonna, which was also wonderful, but it wasn't the scope of this kind of performance.
Right.
They were both wonderful, but they were definitely scaled back because, you know, they weren't being filmed, I think, is part of it, and this was part of it. That she's, you know, cementing her legacy and saying, bitch, this is it.
This is it. You know what I'm saying? And no disrespect to the Mariahs and the Britney Spears and the Madonnas, you know, but I think that for their shows, it might be a rehearsal for maybe 4 or 5 months.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And that's everything. That's music, dancing, all into one. I mean, Mariah, that's just take out the dancing with that. You know what I mean?
And really the singing, because it's like
and the singing,
right?
You know what I'm saying?
I do wish that the documentary on Netflix showed more the inner lives of her ensemble. In the same way that sort of Madonna's Truth or Dare,
the ensemble of just the dancers and the singers,
like we don't know their names, we know their lives, there's their stories, and part of it is like, you know, Madonna's Truth or Dare to me is the quintessential music documentary that I, you know, because it's something I saw when I was coming of age, and it was like it made all these dancers and backup singers into celebrities in their own right.
But then
because of the film,
but you have to think about this. that film was for that. That's why they created that. What Madonna had, that was specifically for the staff and the crew and the background singers and the dancers.
It was made to sort of ignite their careers
for that. But just think about it. If Madonna wouldn't have went a different way about that and say, you know what, I want to focus on me and me getting ready for the show, it would have been totally different.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? So
I feel like we can squeeze any more knowledge out of, cause to me it was like Truth or Dare sort of filled both functions of getting us into Madonna's inner world. And you know, like that scene where she's talking to her father on the phone, eating soup all by herself in the hotel room. Mm-hmm. And it's very unglamorous. And she's like this giant goblet of soup. And the soup sounds delicious. Like the way she's eating it. Yeah, she's eating the soup and she's talking on the phone and she's just like exhausted from doing a show. And part of me is like Homecoming really shows the more we don't see Beyonce struggling with her children or being exhausted the next day or being feeling lonely or isolated. We don't see Beyonce as vulnerable as we know she can be. And I'm hoping that with the two following Netflix specials that she'll sort of choose to let us into that, because I think it's an important thing to reveal about the inner lives of all these superstars.
But for
and it makes it relatable. It makes her a human being and not this sort of like goddess like figure.
For this, I don't think that was her focus.
No, I don't think so.
It wasn't her goal.
But I would like to see that.
Because she could have easily made it about her. But I think what I respect about this is that she wanted to highlight the people that don't get a chance to be highlighted. Mm. Beyonce has always been highlighted. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And I think for this documentary, she wanted to focus more on, because I think like for Madonna, for her, that documentary, she showed some of the performances, but it was more of the behind the scenes, more of her actually showcasing the show. Mm-hmm. And I think for Beyonce, she showcased a lot of the show and then a lot of the behind the scenes. But what she wanted to do was she wanted to focus more on, let me give the band and the dancers and the singers their time to shine. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
She could have easily
focused
that.
More on the concert.
Because, it was more
on
the concert.
And it's also, you know, it was done at Coachella, so maybe that informed what the project was going to be like. Whereas, you know, Truth or Dare was her on tour going to different places.
Exactly. Mean? Exactly.
Yeah. I want to see, like, you know, that's what I'm saying. Is like for the next two documentaries that Netflix, I want to see Beyonce drinking, you know. I want to see the her life that reflects in the songs.
Mm-hmm. But then I think for me personally, sometimes it's good not to see that.
You know, she came to our neighborhood to get pizza once.
Really?
Yeah. She and Jay-Z came over because it was a place called Great Lakes Pizza right around the corner from us.
Okay.
And it was written up like a GQ magazine as one of the best places to get pizza in the world.
So that's why
they came. And I guess, you know, people were just like, I think I just saw Beyonce on the street. And other people were like, oh, no. And then they're like, no, sure enough, it was Beyonce.
Yeah.
And I guess they ordered pizza, but then they went to the restaurant next door to have a little drink before, like, hand. And then they got their pizza. Yeah. And then they left.
And the best thing about being Beyonce is if you come into Andersonville, people won't believe you.
Exactly.
You'll be like, oh,
that's
sure,
drag queen. Right. No, she's drag. She's drag.
What neighborhood do you live in?
I live in the Austin area, so I'm West Side, Chicago, so almost by Oak Park.
Yeah.
Is Austin
getting gentrified, or is it just kind of still just kind of staying where it's at?
Once you get to, and it's funny, because, I live in the Austin area, but at one point, so I'll be honest with you. So there's like this cross street.
Sure.
Before the cross street, you're in the West Side. Mm-hmm. If you go across that cross street, you're in Oak Park.
Oh, sure.
It's that close.
It's very much close. Like Chicago can be. Like neighborhoods are, they're divided. And it's like you just cross the neighborhood and it can be completely
different. And it's a totally different feel. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, even though like me, if I see a crackhead walking down the street, they can easily go over the street light and go into Oak Park, but they just don't cross over and go into.
So when people like in rap songs, they do a shout out to the West Side, they're talking about your neighborhood.
Yes.
Yes. They're not talking about Oak Park.
It's about Oak Park. They're talking about my neighborhood.
Faustin.
Fausto and I saw a lottery day at the Goodman Theater a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. It's an Ike Holter play, and it's one of his seven plays from his Chicago cycle. Some people are calling it like the Reitland cycle because this one takes place in a fictional ward, the 51st Ward. There's 50 wards in Chicago, and so this is the fictional 51st Ward called Reitland. And the story is about a woman named Mallory, and she's the matriarch of this neighborhood, and the neighborhood is becoming gentrified.
Yeah.
And so she has decided she's going to throw this party for her neighbors and her friends. And she had a lot of kids that kind of like grew up at her house, you know, because she took care of the neighborhood and they were like all coming back to have this celebration. But we see that Mallory is like, she's going through some emotional crisis, you know. Mm-hmm. She has a next door neighbor who is like an uppity white woman who's moved in and has like a new, and you can tell because like she's got this, the stage is wonderfully done because you have this old house here and then you have what it looks like some kind of like Lincoln Park monstrosity put up right next to this window with this woman drinking wine looking out the window like, what's happening
like
next door?
Like,
Exactly. And so she throws this party and the concept is like, it's going to be, she's going to give away this money, right?
Yeah.
It's called Lottery Day. And we're like, keep thinking like, where is this money going to come from? Where is it going to come from? And in my mind, you know, we've had people on the podcast before, Zach Stafford, who's written about, you know, police brutality here in Chicago. And they have this idea on the South Side or on, you know, some of these disenfranchised neighborhoods of winning the ghetto lottery, they call it, where it's like if your kid gets killed by a Chicago police officer and they, you know, it's unjustified, you can get a payout of like millions of dollars and stuff like that. And so in my mind, I keep thinking that like that's what's going to happen in this play because it's the lottery day. Like somehow it's going to be announced to be this kind of thing. But then I'm just like, well, this is the Goodman Theater, right?
They're not going to challenge the audience.
They're not going to challenge that. And I wonder if, you know, Ike Holter in his mind is like, that's what he wanted it to be. But in some ways, he's like, I have to tailor it for this kind of audience.
Right.
Because it is sort of like Hamilton, where the audience is mostly, you know, seniors and white. And they're, you know, and part of me is like, I kept expecting a drag queen to come out on stage anytime because I'm so used to sort of seeing that Southern tradition in the Tyler Perry plays.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that the idea of a ridiculous element juxtaposing itself in this African-American melodrama.
Yeah.
Lottery Day's staging, the stage is richly nuanced. It's set in a thrust, which means people sit from the front and sides of the stage.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So, so a lot of it's almost theater in the round.
More like a globe, not globe type.
Yeah,
stage.
it's kind of like the globe, right? So, so you get to really sort of sense what the characters and the actors are doing. And one thing that drives me crazy when I see a lot of plays is like when someone's making a cocktail or you know flipping a burger or something that. It's fake. It's obviously real. And it just snaps me out of my suspension of disbelief. In Lottery Day, you're right there with this really wonderful, almost like Macy's department store window realness, you know?
Yeah.
And every little element, every little item there from the, you know, from the charcoal grill is beautifully thought out and beautifully decorated. And, you know, the acting and the characterization by all the actors, which is there's no straight cisgendered white male character, but it looms over, right?
Yeah.
All these characters are reacting to it.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful play to see, and it's a wonderful play to see with a diverse audience because you start to see how different type of people react to the challenging elements of the show.
Yeah. Who was sitting next to us? She was a woman. She does a Blog Talk Radio. She's an African-American woman. She does a lot of character acting, like on Empire and Chicago PD and all that stuff like that. And she was you know, quiet during the first half, but after intervention, she decided
She had a drink, baby.
She was encouraging the play to go on. Yeah. Really added to the atmosphere, you know. You know, and I'd like to see, you know, this is his seventh, the playwright's seventh play dealing with Chicago. And so I'd like to see some of the other ones and see how they add up. But
I think for us, like the only thing that I've seen in my community is the fact that we have a lot of more of our Hispanic brother and sisters come into the community now. In my
area. Austin's been traditionally been a very black.
Well, honestly, back in the 40s and 50s, of course, Austin was a very Caucasian neighborhood. But then, of course, as the years went on, it became more of a black community. But I see more. Now, I will be honest. We have maybe two or three white families that are still on my block.
Mm-hmm.
They are still there, but they've been there for 40 and sure. 50 years. I mean, they've been there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I have the, like, this lady that's, that lives on my block, she's like 90 something,
mm-hmm.
but she's been there forever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So we still have maybe like one or two.
My friend, when he first moved to Chicago, he was staying with a family out in Austin, mm-hmm. and I took the bus out to like help him get his stuff.
Yeah.
And I just remember going by a beauty salon called Whip the Dew.
Whip the Dew, baby. Whip it. With a real one.
Is it still there?
I know. There's okay. no Whip the Dew.
Earth St. James, where can people follow you and get to know you better and get to the, your gigs on time? And,
So
and enjoy your music.
Yeah. So when it comes to social media, I am Earth St. James on all social media. So E-R-T-H-E. So it's Earth. I take the A out of Earth and add an E.
You don't need the A.
At the end. You don't need the A. Because when I hear Earth, I don't hear an A in Earth. E-R-T-H-E, Earth, Saint, S-T, James, J-A-M-E-S, on all social media. And then for shows, if you go to Bands in Town, if you have the app or the website,
mm-hmm.
you can go to Bands in Town and just type in Earth, E-R-T-H-E, Saint James, and all of my shows are listed there.
And you have a British pound sign because you're all about the money, honey.
I have a British pound sign for two reasons. For the fact that, you know, is I'm all about the money.
Yeah.
Well, actually, three things. I'm all about the money. The other thing is I was very much enthralled and still am in the Spice Girls.
Oh, my God. And you and I like, were talking about this.
I feel like we talked about this
We did.
Right?
But when I was growing up, I was a big Spice Girl fan. I'm still a huge Spice Girl fan. So I think that's just, and they were the group that kind of just said, hey, it's okay to be you and be different and have fun with what you're doing. So I think that British pound sign is my way of paying homage to the Spice Girls. And also, the British pound sign looks like an E.
Sure.
As well, too. So,
Are they coming back? Are they doing it too?
I heard that they, they have
but Victoria now with Victoria
up.
Back in?
Now with Victoria.
Okay.
Correct.
Were you surprised to find out that Jerry Halliwell, Ginger Spice, you
and
know,
Mel B?
And Melody Brown.
No. I wasn't. I wasn't shocked at all. I think
they were lovers for a whole
even back then when I was. So, the Spice Girls, it was 97 when they. Well, 96. So, I was 7. 98. So even by 2000, when they came out with that last album, I was 11 or 12. But even then, as a 11 or 12 year old, I was like, oh, yeah, I know they mess around. And I know to be that young, to think that it's like, where's your mind at? But even then.
Were they all doing, did you know it was those two specifically? Or did you think that there was like a mash pit
I'll
of
be
all
honest
these
with
Spice
you.
Girls, a little spice blend, if you will.
Right. So I always knew, I felt like Scary, which is the black one, if you don't know. But I felt like Scary.
Is that racist that they call her Scary?
She's scary good.
As I've gotten older, I'm like, how do I feel about that?
Mm-hmm.
But back then, I was like, Scary was just like, I interpret it as like being scarcely fierce.
Okay.
Which is like, like I'm out there, like, you know.
Sure, the bold
one. Like, ah.
But it,
so that's how I interpret it.
I do wish they would have used a different word.
I mean it would have fished her, though, but Scary Spice.
I mean, it sounds good, though.
Fierce like, you know. Spice.
My thing is,
you don't have the alliteration.
But if it was a white, you know, if it was, maybe if Sporty Spice was Scary Spice, we wouldn't be saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's like Sporty was never Sporty,
but Bosch Sporty gave me that lesbian Bosch feel.
Yeah.
So I thought that Sporty
would be the one
that you know, because she always gave me that. And can I say it? But she always gave me like that butch or that more of that.
You're asking if you could say the word butch.
I mean that more of that, you know, just kind of rough, like
yeah.
She always gave me that vibe. Mouth. So when I'm sitting even at 7 or 8, I was like, oh, she's the one that likes girls. She likes girls. You know what I mean?
She's the same sex.
Even then, you know what I mean? Even though I wasn't, you know, sexually active, but even then I just knew that she's more tomboyish. You know what I mean?
I always thought Ginger Spice, she definitely.
She gave me that too. She gave me that too.
She was, you know, the one who was.
I knew Posh was more just like, I'm just here just to be seen.
I'm just here for the check.
I'm here for the check. I think Baby
too cool
was
for
too young. Baby was just like, you know, like I'm here because I really want to sing. I feel like Ginger, she was the oldest. So Ginger was like, you know, look, I've been through this role before. I'm just trying to just get on and get my money, get my check. But I'm going to have fun with it. Scary. And then you had, yeah.
I do know that they had extensive auditions to put that Supergirl group together. And right. I want to know, like, who they didn't choose to be in it or who may have gone on to other music careers. Because they usually do, like, narrow it down to some really great talent.
Yeah.
And those other people sort of, you know, make it.
But before before Baby came along, Baby was the last person that got added. It was a girl before Baby. And the girl didn't work out. So they took her out. I forget what her name was, but they took her out and then they added Baby.
I think it was an Indian woman named Cardamom Spice. I'm just kidding.
That was not.
No.
I'm just kidding. That was
not it. I want to remind folks we can't do this podcast. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus because your contribution to the show is what makes this show happen.
Yes.
We also have another way to support this show at our Patreon at patreon.com/feastoffun where you can unlock our vault of goodies, see behind the scenes scenes.
Yeah, you can see photos of us and Duran, you know, just for fans, baby.
Yeah. I just want to say once again, thank you guys for always having me. I love being a part of this. It's such an honor and a privilege. We're doing a picture right now, y'all.
There you go.
Yeah, but I'm so excited. You know, I mean, I'm always happy to get the call to come on.
Honey, I love talking to you. You know,
I
work together at a bakery selling, you know, blueberry and apple and fruit pies. Yeah, you know,
lots of apples and blueberries.
And to me, it's like, I really enjoy the time that I get to spend with you. You know, you're one of my favorite people in the world and I just absolutely adore you. And you're so funny and so much fun.
Thank
and you're such a bold, creative spirit.
Thank you.
I love it when you let your light shine on the world.
Yes.
Earth and St. James.
And I want to say, you know, I know when we're at work at our bakery, making our apple pies, I know that some days I might come in, I'm like, you know what? I just don't feel like talking, but thank you for always like, you know what? I don't care what you say. Hello.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah.
Talk to me.
Sometimes I do come at you hot. You're like, give me some space. I'm just a person.
No, but
Beyonce needs her time.
But I love you.
It is hot in here. The love is real.
But I love you, though.
I love you.
And
you too.
I'm always grateful to be here. Thank you for the opportunity, as always. So thank you, guys.
Hey, guys, if you would love Earth St. James, be a friend, a fan, let him know. Let him know you listen on Feast of Fun.
And I do follow back, people. I do follow back. So if you follow me on Instagram, Facebook, anything, Twitter, I do follow back.
Before we leave, let me ask you, what do you make of this whole Jussie Smollett case? Because now now they're subpoenaing.
That's all we ever talk about.
Now they're subpoenaing attorney Kim Fox. I guess they're trying to get a subpoena for her and talk to her about like what's happening.
What is there left to say?
What is there left to say? When it comes to Jussie. When it comes to that, I mean, I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I don't know.
I think you have a pretty strong opinion about it.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. But
do you
then
feel
again,
like he got jumped by people?
I don't.
No.
But if he did, I think that it was maybe staged and it was maybe planned out. I just don't think that, especially, and I'm not saying that if you are in Chicago that you don't get jumped. People get jumped all the time, especially downtown, especially in those. I mean, it happens. But I just feel like when it happened, it was so cold out.
Minus 30 degrees.
It was minus 30 degrees. So
degrees
who's out there saying, oh, we're going to. And my thing is, if you are out there getting a subway or whatever you're getting, you're not going to be hood off, hat off, no scarf on. You're going to be bundled up, right? And if you're bundled up, who can see your eyes? Who can see your hair? Who can see any characteristics to say, oh, this is Jussie Smollett? Who does that? You know what I'm saying? And I don't know. I mean, maybe people were maybe camping out and watching him. I don't believe it.
Yeah.
I don't believe
it. Because you want to believe the victim, but there's just all these weird things that just kind of don't add up. So
but the like, thing what? With the whole the case of Jussie Smollett is that is just one case.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is that, you know, racism, violence, targeted police brutality targeted at the African American community in cities like Chicago is a real thing.
I agree.
And unfortunately, we're letting this one single case determine what a ongoing harassment and violence towards a community of people. We're turning it into a verdict of that.
Yeah.
And it showcases a failure in our justice system, in our police, in our entertainment and law, and I'm sorry, news organizations.
Yeah.
And those are the things that I'd like to see more top people talking about. It's like, mm-hmm. I don't really care about Jussie Smollett.
Honestly, at this point, I'm over it.
Yeah.
I'm so
yeah.
over
well,
it.
Well, I guess they leaked some of like Kim Fox's like text that she did to,
oh, really?
To the,
I didn't see that.
Yeah. And so she's like, she talks about R. Kelly and calls him like a washed up celebrity who lied to cops, you know.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing is like, you know,
people, no, I'm sorry. She called Smollett a washed up celebrity.
Oh wow.
But that's the thing is like with the Michael Jackson case, with the R. Kelly case, with the Jussie Smollett case, a lot of people are just like weighing in on it and debating it. And I'm like, fantastic and awesome. But it's the cases we don't hear about, the more quieter, more unnerving cases that happen on a regular basis. That's the thing that I'd like to see more discussion.
Or the
about.
Other races.
But it's just hard to talk about.
But just think about this, guys. And mm-hmm. I mean, and I could be, you know, just maybe talking left field. But think about how you have Michael Jackson back in the headlines,
mm-hmm.
R. Kelly, and then Jussie. So you have three black men that people are going heavy on, but we haven't heard anything about Harvey Weinstein. We haven't heard anything about what's the film producer that married his stepdaughter,
Woody Allen.
We haven't heard anything about Woody Allen. It's just like
Trump's still in office.
You know what I'm saying? Like, we haven't heard anything about that, but it's like every other month or every 2 months, it's something about a black entertainer or artist that we're trying to, you know, discredit. And I'm not mm-hmm. saying that they are right. You know what I'm saying? Because they probably are in the wrong, mm-hmm. but it's like, make it fair. Make it fair.
Well, right, it's easier to talk about them because they're not in a position of power.
Right.
And it, part of it is like, we're stuck with Trump.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying because, you know, mm-hmm. when we're talking about the political candidates, you know, Joe Biden just went on The View. And it's a situation where people are just like, you know, really, really nervous that mm-hmm. we're going to get another 4 years or a lifetime of Trump.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to get Trump will leave the White House through the grave. And that's an unnerving thing of Trump as a dictator, as a permanent installed dictator in the United States.
But he won't be. He won't be.
I hope not.
There'll be a revolution.
I also think, you know, I mean, and then we can end, but I think that, okay, yeah, let's talk about Jussie. Let's talk about R. Kelly. But why are we talking about Michael? Why are we doing that?
Michael Sam?
No, Michael Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
Let that man rest.
Mm.
Let him rest.
Mm.
Mm. Like, he's passed on. Like, why are we bringing up, like, are we, so he already died with that you know, that stigma of people saying, oh, he was, you know, a child molester. He already died with that on his back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And now you want to bring up more stuff? The man is dead.
Well,
and
just to add on to this, it's like the one of the guys who's in the documentary, his story is built on it, was actually applying for a job with the Jackson estate up to, I think it was 2 years before the documentary mm-hmm. was started filmed.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of critics of it saying that's his retribution for not getting hired for the job.
Well, let's talk about Elvis. Let's talk about how Elvis had, how old was she?
16.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Lewis, 14, 15.
14, but
they're Southerners, though, so that's, you know, they're from, like, Kentucky and
but
stuff.
Still, know? But are we bringing that back up? Are we going to bring that back up to the forefront mm-hmm. and have a whole documentary that?
People do mention David Bowie having sex with underage women, so, you know, they from time to time.
I never heard that.
People do talk about it, but is there a whole documentary on But, you know, I think that there is something. Michael was just, you know, he was one of the biggest stars ever. And this is somebody that we watch grow up.
I get it. Know? But what's the purpose?
Yeah.
I guess we're bringing awareness to it. Mm-hmm. But what good is it going to do? So we're going to stop playing this music altogether?
You know, to be honest with you, the purpose of it was to sell that documentary.
That's what it was.
You know?
That's what it was.
Because, like, you know, examining him further, like, you know, maybe if you did it in a scholarly way or something like that, you know, definitely needs, you know, could be looked at. But it's like you said, he's dead and he's gone, and, you know,
what's the use?
Do we know?
What's the use?
You know, it's these people that tell us their stories, and we want to believe victims, but it's, you know, what do we really know?
Also, what I would say is, we had, what was it, Neverland, the documentary about that? There's another documentary online.
Martin Bashir's documentary?
Not that one. Okay. It came out maybe like a few months ago, but it was, it's kind of the part two mm-hmm. of the Survivor Neverland. Was it called Survivor Neverland? No. It was called something. But whatever it was for the Michael Jackson documentary, another documentarist did another thing on it. And they kind of talked about how this stuff wasn't true. And they went into detail on how this was really a conspiracy, you know, to mm-hmm. try to take him down.
Because Michael started owning his own work.
He was owning his own work. He had bought the Beatles.
Mm-hmm. That pissed off Paul McCartney.
That pissed off a lot of people. Yeah. The fact that this, you know, black man is buying all of
sleep in beds with children.
He did sleep in bed. But
that
my thing is
weird.
But it is weird. But my thing is, if you are a pedophile, mm-hmm. if you are a rapist, if you are anything that you know you shouldn't be doing, who would go on camera? Remember when he did the Martin Bashir thing? Mm-hmm. He said, yes, I do. Sometimes I'm in the bed with them. They want to sleep in the bed with me. I'm Michael Jackson. They want to sleep in the bed with me. Or I'll sleep on the floor. Like, my thing is, like, if you're a rapist, if you're a pedophile, who would admit that?
The thing is, if you're a millionaire entertainer, there's always somebody wanting to sue you for any reason.
That's what I'm saying.
And so regardless of whether or not he harmed those children, it was irresponsible for him to put his family in danger by opening himself up to litigation and to scrutiny.
I agree.
And no matter how much you love those children, you know, set some boundaries.
You should know better. I agree.
And this is why the moral of the story here is celebrate and love the people who tell you no. Because you may think you have a good idea, but the people, and no one could tell Michael Jackson no. He was surrounded by people who said, you want some propofol? Have two bottles, baby. And he woke up dead, you know? And it was that, and that's the people who tell us no, the limits in our lives, as painful as those limits and those rejections can be, man's rejection is God's protection.
It's needed.
You know? And I thank you for accepting and not rejecting our invitation to coming back on the show.
Now, I will say, I'm not defending Michael. I'm not saying that he was in the right. He could have been in the wrong, but I just want people to look at all the facts.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to anything, when it comes to any situation that's being portrayed in the media, just look at both sides.
Well, it's also more juicy to talk about Michael Jackson as opposed to somebody you don't know who,
of course,
you know, something that's not as glamorous or full of, you know, entertainment and personality and music and stuff like that.
Exactly.
Earth St. James, thank you so much for coming
on
the show.
Thank you, guys. I'm so appreciative always to be here.
I adore you. I love you. I love the listeners for coming on the show, for listening on with us.
Yes. Come back soon.
Oh, I would love to.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, y'all. Peace.
Mm-hmm.